7BR Part Heard.
Hello, and welcome to 7BR's Part Heard, the podcast that traverses the legal landscape, examining issues across multiple practice areas, guided by the diverse expertise of our members. I'm Rhys Palmer, Chambers Paralegal. We're joined today by two previous podcast guests, Rose Harvey Sullivan and Jim Rowbottom. Jim and Rose have been instructed by ATLU in respect of claims brought by survivors of modern slavery. Today, they'll be discussing the outcome of two of those cases. Rose has a mixed civil and family practice. She specialises in representing vulnerable clients in clinical negligence and personal injury claims, inquests, court of protection cases, and child law. Having a multidisciplinary practice means that Rose brings additional perspectives and expertise to a particular instruction. Jim has a multidisciplinary practice with particular emphasis on and experience in tort law and human rights and equality law. Jim has particular expertise in relation to the law of modern slavery. He appeared in the Supreme Court in 2016 in Onu and Akwiwu, and in 2020 in A&B and Sika. He represents the victims of Cozy Sleep and Operation Fort human trafficking conspiracies in their compensation claims against companies that failed to prevent forced labour in the UK. Rose, Jim, welcome back to the podcast.
Hi, Rhys.
Hi, Rhys.
Rose, could you just explain to us who ATLU are?
Yeah, of course. So ATLU stands for the Anti-Trafficking and Labour Exploitation Unit, and they are a charity who provide legal advice and support to survivors of slavery and trafficking. But essentially, they are involved in quite a number of sort of high-profile challenges to various areas of law, which sort of in this area really around slavery. So they're often kind of involved in cases that shape the way that the law is developing, and it is quite a fast-moving area of law. One of the areas they specialise in is in respect of compensation for survivors.
Jim, before we delve into the substantive discussion of today's podcast, could you just perhaps give us a background to the claims?
Yeah, sure. So Mr. Magyar and Mr. Toth are survivors of a human trafficking conspiracy in 2012-2013, where Hungarian nationals were trafficked from Hungary by a human trafficking ring and put to work at ostensibly legitimate UK businesses. By far the biggest and most widely known of those was a company called Cozy Sleep, which made mattresses amongst other clients for John Lewis. The format of the human trafficking conspiracy was that vulnerable people in Hungary, perhaps with alcohol dependency syndrome or who hadn't had work for some time, were promised good wages and work in England and their travel and accommodation paid. If they went essentially and travelled with these traffickers, they did so. When they got here, they were in fact housed in squalid accommodation, and the traffickers took control. They opened mobile phone accounts and bank accounts in their names and took control of their lives, and they forced them to work in these UK factories. And the traffickers were successfully prosecuted in around 2014. Cozy Sleep, the managing director, was successfully prosecuted in 2016. But some of the survivors worked for small different companies in West Yorkshire. And Mr. Magyar and Mr. Toth were two of these. There are other claims arising from the Cozy Sleep conspiracy, for instance, a case of Comives, which was reported last year, where it was held that claims couldn't be brought under a contract of insurance. But in these claims, when the claimants eventually got to get legal aid and advice, the businesses, unlike Cozy Sleep, which went bust, were still functioning, and so they were ostensibly viable defendants. So Mr. Magyar and Mr. Toth set about bringing claims against Metal Powder Coating. They issued those claims in 2018 because of delays in the granting of legal aid and because the criminal proceedings were going on. The claims were brought primarily in tort, but also in contract for the unpaid wages. What would happen with the wages was that the traffickers would come to the factory and the managing director of Metal Powder Coating would pay the traffickers directly. So the claims were in contract for that, but for personal injury, psychiatric injury arising from their experience at the factory and their trafficking, and for intimidation and harassment, because the managing director of the factory actually gave them instructions that they had to work, or he would tell the traffickers on the kind of shop floor, as it were. So that's where we were, and they were progressing to, Mr. Magyar's was progressing to trial, and there was a trial due to happen in the High Court in April. But in late 2020, it became clear that there were issues in relation to whether Metal Powder Coating was a viable defendant that had sufficient assets to meet a judgment. And at that point, thankfully, Simmons & Simmons LLP, the large commercial firm solicitors, got involved and helped us pro bono in ascertaining what was really going on with Metal Powder Coating's assets.
So you mentioned Metal Coating being a viable defendant and ascertaining whether or not they had any assets. Rose, could you just explain why that's important and the steps that are available to claimants in these sorts of circumstances?
Yeah, well, when you bring a claim, one of the reasons you'll do that is so that you are sort of vindicated by the court. A lot of claimants in various types of cases will say, well, you know, I wanted to be proved right, I wanted my story to be heard or whatever. But the other side of that is, particularly when somebody, for example, hasn't been paid for work they've done, is that they have a financial claim. And so it was important for our claimants that they could recover financially for what they had lost as a result of the traffickers' actions. And so that's only possible if the defendants have money. And so we had to check what money Metal Powder Coating had. And originally, when the claims were issued, they were very much a viable business, and they sort of had a high turnover in the hundreds of thousands, and, you know, number of staff working for them, etc. But what became clear by the end of 2020 was that the business was, according to the documents at Companies House, balance sheet insolvent. So Metal Powder Coating were telling us through their solicitors, we don't have any money, whatever happens, you know, you're not going to be able to recover anyway. So that's obviously a big concern for the claimants, because they're going through an awful lot for the trial. So one of the things that we looked at with Simmons & Simmons was whether it was correct that Metal Powder Coating had no assets. But one of the other things we started to explore was whether there were other people or third parties who we could potentially recover against in the event that the court found in the claimant's favour. And one of the ways you can do that is by using freezing injunctions against companies where it becomes clear that the assets have been kind of dissipated too, if you like. So if you can trace the assets, there are various sort of circumstances in which it's important that they can be traced. But without going into too much detail on that front, effectively, if you can trace the assets to other third parties, they can also be subject to a freezing injunction, as well as the defendant themselves.
And is this what you did with Metal Powder Coating?
So what we established when we started looking into Metal Powder Coating was that the director, Mr. Fulat, in fact, was the director of six other companies, all with either remarkably similar names or working from the same premises as Metal Powder Coating and basically doing the same stuff. So we started to track the similarities between the companies so that we could try and show that there were some links. And what we could see on, for example, the Companies House documents was that several of them were set up in the weeks and months following issue of the claims. And they started to then accrue assets from that point onwards. And that tallied with the time at which the original defendant, Metal Powder Coating, was losing assets. So we were seeing effectively companies from the same location doing the same thing, brand new, set up in light of the claims having been issued, which seemed to be effectively having the assets which Metal Powder Coating would have had. And so the concern was that they were dissipating Metal Powder Coating's assets in order to avoid paying the claimants what they would have been due at the end of any proceedings. And another point that was notable we found was that Mr. Fulat himself had actually, I think it was something like 12 days after issue of proceedings in one of the claims, had passed his ownership of his own family home to a family member for no funds. And so again, it's sort of suspicious circumstances where it looked like assets were being moved away directly after proceedings had started. So those were the kinds of assets that we were able to try and focus our attention on. Once we'd kind of collated all of our evidence to suggest that assets were being moved in these suspicious ways, we made our application for a without notice freezing injunction. So that meant that the defendant was not informed about it, and neither were the other six companies. But ultimately, after a hearing in the High Court, all seven of the businesses were subject to the freezing injunction, because the court was satisfied that there was a risk that if we only did it for some of the companies, others might try and get rid of some of the assets in other ways. And they felt that the situation was sufficiently questionable, that that was what was needed in order to kind of shore things up pending a further hearing. We did have one further hearing, which was effectively a holding position. But then before we got to a substantive hearing of the freezing injunction, the defendant started being quite sensible about settlement offers. And so we managed to actually secure settlements for the claimants at that stage, which were quite favourable to them. So the freezing injunction had a very direct effect in terms of achieving an outcome for the claimants. Because we'd suspected all along their claims were pretty strong. We had some good evidence for the underlying claims. But because the defendant kept saying to us, well, there's no money in the business, we won't pay even if you win, they hadn't made sensible offers for settlement. But the freezing injunctions kind of settled, focused their minds a bit.
And so freezing injunctions against all these other companies, that's not a usual step that a court will take, is it?
Well, you have to be able to show those links in terms of the assets. So that was why it was really important we got our ducks in a row in terms of the timings of the companies being set up and the fact that they all had the same director. They were all operating from the same premises. Some of them had the same phone numbers, the same websites. So it was really important that we could show all of those links. There is case law that suggests that it's perfectly legitimate to go after third parties in those situations. But obviously, the court's got to be far more careful about granting freezing injunctions in those circumstances, because you're stepping outside the parties who are already involved in the proceedings. So that was why it was really important we had to kind of make all those links, prima facie links, first and foremost.
So with other cases, or cases that are similar to this one, how has your case helped to aid practitioners going forward?
I mean, in one sense, it hasn't, right? Because it's not a reported case. If it had gone to trial,
of course,
it would have been a reported High Court authority that we settled beforehand. I mean, it's important, we feel, to get out that the case occurred, because what has happened is that modern slavery claims are kind of a new type of claim. It's mainly because legal aid is available for victims to bring compensation claims, both in the employment tribunal and in the civil courts. That has been the case for a while, but they're only just the kind of first cases beginning to trickle through. I know there was a freezing injunction in a different trafficking case, which concerned Lithuanian chicken farms, a case called Ansusis and Houghton a few years ago, but the circumstances were different here. There are, as Rose says, a few notable things we think about the injunctions being granted in the circumstances they were. It was close to trial. It was by legally aided claimants. I think there is a presumption that freezing injunctions are there for kind of wealthy commercial clients to, you know, bring applications for in the Queen's Bench Division or the commercial court. But this was an example of really vulnerable victims with no assets bringing them, because of the ability that legal aid, or potential that legal aid gives them to do so, and because it was possible, as Rose says, to make the application successfully against non-party companies. So really, it's just to get the message out there that that can be done in these kind of claims, because one feature of trafficking cases is that the traffickers and the companies who conspired to use traffic labour or used it in individual cases are, in my experience, quite likely to go out of business. So in the Cozy Salute cases, the main company has gone out of business, and then the trafficking survivors are left trying to sue insurance companies who, in some cases, avoided the contract of insurance. So they can't get remedies in those situations. And indeed, the problems with getting compensation direct from traffickers are recognised in the European Convention Against Trafficking, which the explanatory report to Article 15, which is the compensation, the right to compensation under what's called ECAT, says specifically that traffickers are unlikely to be able to meet a judgment because they will either be impecunious or they'll have fled, essentially. So we feel it's an important case in getting out the message that you can take steps on behalf of survivors to secure the assets of these companies who have behaved unlawfully in putting them to work, and that you can use the powers of the High Court, which are, you know, more extreme than, say, in labour law, in employment law kind of cases, to secure those assets and to secure a remedy for these vulnerable survivors.
Just one thing to add to that, which I think is important to mention, is that often with freezing injunctions, applicants are required to make an undertaking to court. That is, they have to pay some money into court so that in the event that the freezing injunction shouldn't have been made, they can make up for any loss that the respondent has suffered as a result. But in this case, the judge was persuaded that these applicants, because of their circumstances, and because particularly because the fact that their case was that they were impecunious, as in they didn't have any money, was because of the defendant themselves, the judge said they didn't actually have to pay any undertakings into court when we first made our application. And that's another thing that a lot of lawyers may be concerned about for their clients and might step back from making an application for a freezing injunction if they think their client would have to pay some thousands of pounds into court and their client just doesn't have that kind of money. But actually what the court said in this case was, we don't need that. We're persuaded that, well, public interest as much as anything else means that otherwise this area of law wouldn't be accessible solely on the basis that these claimants wouldn't have that kind of money. And that's wrong. So that's another fact that we felt was important and that needs to be kind of shared really with other practitioners in this area, because it's another indicator, one of the sort of reassuring factor maybe for them.
Thank you, Rose. Thank you, Jim. It's been a pleasure having you on. Jim, where can our listeners find out more about this case?
Yeah, so we've obviously talked quite informally about it as an introduction today, but we've put more detail in an article that's available both on Chambers website and also on Apt Hub, which is Atlu's resource, online resource, which is available on their website for people representing trafficking victims. We've put the relevant legal tests there and what happened legally and the arguments in favour of getting injunctions against third party, non-parties. So, yeah, that's the place to look.
Jim, Rose, once again, thank you for coming on. Thank you to our listeners. If you enjoyed this week's episode, you can find more episodes like this from Rose, Jim, and other members of Chambers on 7BR's website, or across other streaming platforms such as Apple Music and Spotify. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.